Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. And there's no one I prefer to tour it with than our first guest. She is Diana West, who joins us each week about now. And she has been observing and writing about and articulating in the most elegant of fashion her thoughts about the challenges that we're facing as a country on sort of the cultural side, as well as the national security piece. She is the author of The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization, and a brand new book, which she actually handed me a copy of. A galley proof, to be sure, but it is real. It is coming. American Betrayal, The Secret Assault of our Nation's Character. She's also a syndicated columnist and, as I said, a wonderful and valued regular guest here at Secure Freedom Radio. Diana, welcome. It's good to have you with us, as always.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be back.
Let's talk a little bit about the State of the Union address last night. Speaking of the character of the nation at the moment and of our leadership, general thoughts, observations, issues associated with it.
Yes, well, you know, you watch a newly elected president stride down and take the stage on Capitol Hill, and in 2013, the United States is $6 trillion deeper in debt than when he first approached us 4 years ago. So it's a strange phenomenon to watch the sort of triumphant presentation of this new term that is running on empty on top of the old term. And so it's a perplexing moment, I think, for Americans. And you certainly got a lot of smoke and mirrors last night.
Yeah. And I was struck, I think Senator Ted Cruz mentioned that there were no budget cuts, not a single one mentioned. And more to the point, there was a brand new entitlement program unveiled, giving every four-year-old a preschool program of some kind. This seems so completely disconnected from reality. If the reality is indeed that we are, as you say, deeper and deeper and deeper in the financial hole.
Absolutely. And of course, there was also talk of a $9 an hour minimum wage.
Oh, yes,
so again, another whack at business, certainly in the private sector. So again, it's just a strange presentation. It's a strange tradition. I find the singling out of the individuals that has now become the tradition in these speeches, I suppose inaugurated by Ronald Reagan years ago, to just become kind of another sort of tired device that is supposed to work on our emotional reaction to give us a happy glow at the end. And you know,
this was so obviously clearly the case with respect to these victims of so-called gun violence.
Yes, yes.
The thing I was struck by, Diana, I just wondered what your reaction to this was. He went into this, well, I can only call it demagogic, sort of bullying partisan mode in pronouncing that each of these people deserved a vote. And, you know, I was just thinking about all of the issues that are before us, notably in the United States Senate. For example, a budget, which
yeah,
they've not been allowed to have a vote on for 4 years. The idea that, you know, defense sequestration cuts might be staved off through a bill that Kelly Ayotte has offered in the Senate. Well, that would seem to me deserve a vote. And so would the cuts that the president has in the offing, apparently, further unilateral executive action-induced cuts to our nuclear deterrent. Well, that would deserve a vote.
Right.
But Diana, what's
right.
going on? They don't seem to be on the president's to-do list at all, or that of Harry
no.
Reid.
No, it seems like pure demagoguery. And in terms of the vote, my ears pricked up when he also announced a supposedly bipartisan committee to improve to streamline voting in this country. And when you look at back at the tremendous number of stories reporting allegations of fraud on the Democratic side in this last election, it's very troubling because it seems like what they're looking toward is perhaps further computerization of the vote, perhaps voting online. I was trying to think what could streamline the vote except for getting people out of line. It's very
troubling.
What is going on? Why
don't
is that
want
necessary?
To wait. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
But and here's the thing. I hope that one of the people who will be participating in this is our friend Catherine Engelbrecht, who has been responsible for a terrific effort, a grassroots effort called True the Vote, to maximize voter integrity. And this is really wanting at the moment. I'm told there are very few people who actually were forced to wait in long lines, but that what is really being done here is an extension of the vote to all kinds of people under this rubric, whether they're illegal aliens, whether they're people who for other reasons are not entitled to citizenship or the right to vote.
Exactly, and it's very troubling, and it should be. It should be something of great alarm to Americans, and yet the president couches it in a completely different angle, and you know, we'll have to wait and see what that is, but it does not bode well.
It does not.
Yeah.
We'll be watching it closely, as I know will you, Diana West. Let me turn to something that's a little bit more in our wheelhouse, Diana. You've written a piece on your post at dianawest.net entitled Little Orphan Benghazi. Tell us about what we learned from Leon Panetta and General Martin Dempsey last week about President Obama and the Benghazi attack being MIA at a critical moment.
Yes, both Secretary of Defense Panetta and Joint Chiefs Chairman Dempsey very clearly stated under repeat questioning by the Senate that they had no further contact from President Obama or the White House or White House staff. Panetta was very specific. After a 5 o'clock scheduled briefing at which they first apprised him that the compound in Benghazi was under attack, In a regular briefing that also included discussion of the attack on the embassy in Cairo and goodness knows what else, this was a very shocking moment, very dramatic moment. And of course, we did not read about it in the New York Times or the Washington Post.
No,
I would add,
of course not.
We saw fit not even to cover this. I mean, it was jaw dropping. I went back and reread the transcript just to make sure and watched it on
you
YouTube.
You hadn't seen something that nobody else had seen. Yeah, go.
Exactly. You kind of learn to distrust. You want to double check yourself. But this is now. I have talked to many different people we would consider experts since that moment last week, and it's interesting. Some people truly believe that both Panetta and Dempsey were lying to the Senate, and other people believe, no, he was AWOL. But the notion that this is open to interpretation, it shows how little we actually know, how little we trust the administration, and how important it is to drive this forward.
It really is. And Diana, one of the other things that has emerged in a new book by two former Special Forces officers is a picture of what was going on the ground that also has not been made clear in the course of such investigations as we've had on the Hill, specifically what they call covert operations involving arms that, of course, are all over the place in Libya today. What more do we know about that now, and what does it tell us about what the Obama administration has been up to?
Well, to bring an old-fashioned word, it sounds like they've been doing a lot of cowboy action, supposedly unbeknownst to senior members of the Obama administration, which is kind of hard to believe. I did notice I have not yet read the book. I did, with my Nook, scan it for a certain pieces of the story that I have been following, and I note that they did not mention the Zawahiri video in which he exhorted Libyans specifically to avenge the killing of an al-Qaeda leader from Libya that went up on jihad sites a day or so before the attack on the consulate. I find that omission unusual or strange, given that they are calling the book a definitive account, because that, of course, is one piece that the administration has denied and not or at least not discussed, not been pursued on in terms of their own preparations for 9/11 attack.
In favor of this meme that, of course, it was really just this video and people saying hateful things about Muslims that was responsible. We will be studying up on Benghazi, the definitive report by Brandon Webb and Jack Murphy, and we'll both be talking more about it, I know, in the days ahead. Diana West, thank you so much for joining us, as always, and thank you for your insights into this cultural dimension of the war for the free world. It is as important a battle space as any. Diana West, syndicated columnist and author of American Betrayal. We'll be speaking with you next week. Next up, we'll be speaking with Steve Bucci about President Obama's new executive order on cyber warfare and much more. Straight ahead.
You think? Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
This hurricane season, coastal residents in the southeast and the Gulf states are urged to prepare for the uncertain conditions they may encounter in the aftermath of a major storm and make their annual contingency plans. In addition to other emergency essentials, the American Red Cross and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security recommend residents keep a diversified emergency wallet that includes cash and traveler's checks. American Express traveler's checks provide an extra measure of financial safety and security. Keeping traveler's checks and a supply of cash in small bills offers storm victims payment options to make necessary purchases. Traveler's checks never expire, providing a secure payment method whenever emergencies occur, this year and in the future. Unlike cash, they're refundable if lost or stolen. American Express traveler's checks are available at banks, credit unions, and American Express Travel Service locations across the Gulf Coast and Southeast regions. For more information, please visit www.americanexpress.com/travelerschecks.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We have a man I enjoy enormously interacting with. He is the director of the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies at the highly prized Heritage Foundation. He comes to that position with a very distinguished record of service in the United States Army, including as the commander of the 3rd Battalion of the 5th Special Forces in the United States Army. He is Steve Bucci. And Steve, it is always a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Frank. Glad to be here.
We've been talking in the program about the State of the Union address. I probably will talk on this with each of our guests. Just very quickly, your thoughts on the president's remarks, most especially as they relate or failed, for that matter, to relate to the national security challenges of our time.
Well, I think he still has a little bit of Pollyanna as far as national security. His sort of light footprint kind of comment shows his propensity to like drones and special operations forces, both of which are wonderful capabilities, but alone are not going to be anywhere near enough to meet the readiness and defense needs of this country.
And Steve, as a former Special Forces operator and commander, you perhaps better than most understand that you can't really use those guys effectively, certainly not in a sustained way, a safe for them way, in the absence of a substantial capability in terms of conventional forces. Am I right?
Well, I mean, you can use them sometimes for specific operations alone, but that doesn't make a national defense policy. That's sort of a one-off.
Right.
You're right. They need to be integrated, particularly for a global power, into a more conventional defense structure. And frankly, you know, they can't do everything. They're very, very good at tasks they are trained to do, but they're small, they're light, they're very specialized, and they do not a national defense structure make, not by themselves.
And to the extent that this is this emphasis is accompanied, Steve, as you know so well, by the, well, draconian cuts, I think it's fair to call them, that are now in the offing, as well as those that have already taken place, are you concerned about the hollowing out of the military and the likelihood that, that footprint will be so light it may be wholly inadequate to the task?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've been through two hollowing out periods in our military, one after Vietnam and the other after the Cold War. And it's a scary feeling among the military, you know, particularly when, as this president has said, he's going to exempt the personnel accounts. So you're going to end up with people, but people who are not ready to do the missions that they may be called upon to execute. The thing that really makes our military better than everybody else's is, it's some sort of mundane, but we practice more. We have pilots who fly more in a year than most Air Force's pilots fly in a career. And that's why they're so good. But that costs money. And when you cut back on the funding for bullets and gas and other things that maintain proficiency and readiness, you're not ready. And it means when the balloon really goes up and you go somewhere to fight, whether it be a small affair or a large one, guys die. And that's not what this country needs, and it's not what our young men and women deserve.
Yeah, and that is a problem, not just for them, of course. It's also a problem for the rest of us. Steve Bucci is our guest. He is a retired colonel in the United States Army Special Forces. He also is currently with the Heritage Foundation. And Steve, one of the things we've also been touching on is, as a special operator, I know you almost certainly have been following closely what went on in Benghazi. The loss of two former Special Forces servicemen, among others, of course, their ambassador as well. What do you make of the fact that we're now learning from senior defense officials that the president was essentially MIA?
You know, it's kind of unfortunate and baffling to me that, you know, it wasn't like Libya was a surprise. It was a hotbed. We had just, you know, fought there. That this nascent government was in place. It's on September 11th, and in all my dealings with the government on September 11th, since September 11th, 2001, we kind of ratchet up the readiness and the precautions because you're expecting something to happen. And this time it did, and you can't get hold of the guy who's in charge.
The whole government seemed to have been basically off duty. It seems the State Department wasn't up on the comms, and of course we were not getting any orders going into those who might have provided some relief.
Well, I think what happened was the government started to believe their own narrative that they were pushing, frankly, for electoral purposes, that the tides of war had receded, that Al Qaeda was defeated. And frankly, it wasn't true. I mean, it was a fallacy, and I think they may have bought into it, and that left them unready. And as my old boss, Secretary Rumsfeld, used to say, the president is never not in charge.
Right.
And it doesn't matter where he is or what he's doing. He is still the ultimate boss.
So true. This was a meme that was propounded again in the State of the Union last night. You know, Al Qaeda's essentially washed up, and yeah, there are these other folks who have some association with him, but everything's on track. And I, just speaking of Don Rumsfeld, and you served as his military assistant starting in July 2001. And Steve, I turning to another topic. topic. Chuck Hagel is now a step closer to becoming one of his successors. And I was really struck and thought of you immediately when Senator Hagel, in the course of his appalling performance before the Senate Armed Services Committee, said, among other things, that his was not going to be a policy position. What did you make of that?
That's insane. I mean, the Secretary of Defense is quintessentially a policy position. It is the national security defense policy position. That role, aside from being in the chain of command or military, he is the primary civilian advisor for security issues to the President of the United States. If he doesn't think that defines a policy position, then Mr. Hagel is even more confused than I thought he was.
Yeah, and even more unsuited for the job, I would argue. Hey, quickly, because we're almost out of time, and there's lots to talk about on this front. You are one of the country's leading experts on cyber warfare. You were a lead consultant to IBM on that subject. You served as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Homeland Defense and Defense Support to Civil Authorities. Steve Bucci, talk about the president's announcement yesterday that he had a new executive order on cyber security, and we're hearing a lot about offensive operations, particularly from National Public Radio these days. Talk to us about where we are in the realm of cyber warfare and where we need to go from here.
Well, you know, the president tries to make it sound like it's a partisan issue, and it's not. It's bipartisan in both directions as to what is the right thing for our government to do to give us better cybersecurity. The president, unfortunately, thinks it should be government regulation of the 19th century variety, and a lot of us think it's wholly unsuited to address cyber, and that's what the Congress was working through. That's why they haven't passed a law yet. It's not that they're lazy or incompetent. It's that there are honest differences as to what the right thing is to do. The president, by putting out this executive order, is totally circumventing the system and is going to come up with a suboptimal solution, and that's just wrong.
Can you very quickly, Steve, because this is a very complicated subject, I know, but can you very quickly describe what the fundamental differences are between the parties or between the executive and legislative branches, for that matter?
The president and certain members of Congress think that is if you just set a standard, a static standard, which is what regulatory policies do, and tell everybody you have to get to this standard, that they'll be safer. The problem with that is cyber is such a dynamic field that as soon as you set that static standard, even if people haven't reached it yet, the big guys know they have to go a little bit beyond that, and then we're into the systems. So it gives you a completely false sense of security. It's a waste of money. And frankly, the Department of Homeland Security, who would have the enforcement part of this, is wholly unsuited to be a regulatory organization and have shown in the times they've tried it before that they're not really good at it. So this is going to be a great thing. He'll get to brag that he fixed this, except it won't really be fixed, Frank.
It won't be fixed.
Insecure.
Yeah.
The problem with it.
Steve Bucci, thank you for this very quick introduction. We want you back for a much, much more deep drill down on what not only is wrong with our cybersecurity, but what we need to be doing about it. Colonel Bucci, we appreciate your service to our country, past, present, and future, at the Heritage Foundation most immediately. Keep up the good work. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we have Patrick Christie from the Foreign Policy Initiative. We'll get into some of these issues with him as well. Straight ahead.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Barack Obama previewed the true tenor of his second term during the State of the Union address last night. He closed with a repeated incantation about all the victims of gun-delivered violence who deserve a vote, suggesting the president intends to take American politics to a new level of demagoguery and bullying partisanship. But Mr. Obama seems curiously indifferent to other matters that also deserve a vote. A Senate budget deserves a vote. Senator Ayotte's bill staving off devastating sequestration defense cuts deserves a vote. The president's reported unilateral elimination of one-third of our nuclear arsenal deserves a vote. Will Mr. Obama insist that the Senate vote on issues like these? Actually, he seems happy to have Majority Leader Harry Reid prevent that from happening, even though the American people deserve these votes. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedomradio.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Patrick Christie. He is a senior policy analyst with an organization that I've come to regard very highly. It's called the Foreign Policy Initiative, a relatively new organization in Washington specializing in national security affairs. Patrick, it's good to have you with us, I think, for the first time. Welcome aboard.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I wanted to talk with you kind of first and foremost about the State of the Union address and the almost complete absence of any serious attention to the state of our union as it relates to the rest of the world. The president, you know, sort of made the obligatory comments about, we'll have the most powerful military in the world, and North Korea is kind of a threat. But there really didn't seem to be much interest in addressing the natty problems that are developing. What was your take on all of that, Patrick?
Oh, you know, I think that's exactly right. I think there's very little emphasis on foreign policy. As some people have written, this was an address about the middle class and not the Middle East. And, you know, in many ways, that could be a mistake. You know, there are a number of challenges that we in this country continue to face around the world. Instability in the Middle East, you know, rising questions about kind of the interests of China in the Asia Pacific. And, you know, most importantly, we face in less than 3 weeks a massive defense cuts, which will really hinder our ability to project power and protect our interests around the world.
Yeah, you at FPI and the Heritage Foundation and the American Enterprise Institute have been working, as have a number of us, but you've come together to put forward an impressive letter, really urging, as the president did, to be fair, in his way, that these sequestration cuts not be allowed to be imposed on the Defense Department. Give us a sense of if you can, both what you think is the most compelling argument for that stay of execution, at the very least, and what you made of the president's comments about it.
Well, I think, as you mentioned, our organization helped organize an open letter to members of Congress the other day, and it's signed by, you know, about 45 former government officials, senators. You know, Senator Joe Lieberman was on the list, and also former secretaries of defense. And really what we're saying, as you mentioned, we have all been saying for a very long time, is these cuts will be catastrophic in terms of our ability to protect our interests around the world. And I think when you look at what Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta has said, you know, he's called this a shameful act of irresponsibility and repeatedly warned that these indiscriminate cuts
across the board
will truly devastate our national security. Exactly. And you know, the problem here is that we've created a strategy for our, you know, Department of Defense that protects our interests around the world. And this just indiscriminately slashes from that, which really makes us unable to carry out, you know, those missions. And that, I think, is a serious problem that we face.
Yeah. And Patrick, one of the things I was struck by is that, of course, the president himself has scaled back that strategy on the basis of the previous rounds of cuts. And what we're clearly now put in the position of doing is trying to make that I would argue, inadequate strategy work with even fewer resources. That clearly won't happen. What did you make of the president's professions of concern about this last night? Did that suggest to you that he's determined to prevent these sequestration rounds of across-the-board reckless slashing to keep it from happening?
You know, unfortunately, it looks like this is just kind of more rhetoric versus call to action. You know, we've heard this before from the White House. During the campaign, the president said that, you know, this will not happen under his watch. And the fact is, it looks like it will happen. And, you know, he did say that this is, you know, sequestration, these cuts were a really bad idea last night. But there's no serious proposal to avert these cuts. And the House of Representatives passed a bill in May that would do that, would, you know, reverse these cuts. And, you know, while there was a slight 2-month delay, you know, passed in December by Congress, there's really very little indication here in Washington that any change is coming down the pike.
This is the thing that it just breeds a level of cynicism about this president and his policies. I was saying with our guest Diana West in a previous segment, Patrick Christie, that you know, if victims of gun violence deserve a vote, as the president insisted repeatedly last night, it seems to me that the American people deserve a vote in the Senate on this effort by Kelly Ayotte and others to prevent sequestration from being inflicted with such devastating effect on the defense establishment. Let me turn to another topic, if I may. You've also engineered out of FPI, I believe, a letter concerning a very important, in fact, I would argue one of the most important foreign policy challenges we're facing at the moment, seemingly completely unawares as far as the administration is concerned, namely Turkey. What are your concerns about Turkey, Patrick, and where do you think they're likely to go from here?
Well, Turkey, you know, Turkey is an interesting question. In many ways, Turkey faces a choice really between two different futures. And one of those futures is more closely aligned with Europe, the United States, and the West. The other choice, the other option, is as it moves towards some countries in the Middle East and, you know, Islamization or extremism. And right now it's kind of unclear. While Turkey has taken, you know, some very positive steps in the last 15 years to kind of, you know, move away from military. Right now, they have civilian control over the military. They've taken some moderate steps in terms of elections, but in recent years, they've taken steps backwards, and that's what we're really worried about. So, as you allude to, our organization co-authored a letter with various human rights organizations, Freedom House, Project on the Middle East Democracy, and Reporters Without Borders, basically asking the president to bring up these issues with Turkey. Turkey's a long-standing, invaluable ally. They are a member of the NATO alliance, but increasingly we are facing kind of these strategic challenges and need Turkey at our side, and Turkey's behavior is really raising some serious questions, I would say.
Patrick Christie is our guest. He is with the Foreign Policy Initiative, where he serves as a senior policy analyst. He previously worked for two Republican organizations, the Republican National Committee and the National Republican Congressional Committee. You can find his writings in numerous distinguished places, including The Commentator, The Diplomat, National Review Online, and the Weekly Standard and U.S. News and World Report. Patrick, let me ask you this, because I share your concerns about what's happening to human rights in Turkey, but I must say I'm persuaded that this is really just a symptom of a much larger problem with the Islamization of Turkey under Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And what that suggests about, and you sort of alluded to this in your comment a moment ago, where Turkey is headed as an ally. It is a NATO ally, as a recipient of American advanced weapons technology and intelligence. Should we be concerned about those issues as well as human rights?
There are some concerns. The current government there is definitely moving in various directions that raise some questions. And whether it's transforming the justice system, reshaping the high courts, there are serious questions. And also when you look at the role of women and women in the government, we're seeing fewer and fewer women in prominent positions in the government. So I think there are some serious concerns, but that's why it's so important for leaders here in Washington to raise these issues with, the government of Turkey and really make clear to them their future is with the West and with, in partnership with the United States, because, Turkey needs our help. They need, foreign investment, and so as they face these challenges, it's in their interest to work with Western countries in Europe and the United States.
Hmm. Well, I hope they see it that way. I'm not persuaded that they're even being encouraged to see it that way, let alone that they actually have that sort of attitude, at least among Erdogan's circle. There presumably are people elsewhere in the country and in the military, most especially, who do, but they seem to be increasingly marginalized, if not actually actively suppressed by folks who feel that they may get investment from, the Middle East and elsewhere. They can align themselves with impunity with Iran and behave increasingly in ways, including, I think, in Syria, among other places, quite at odds with our interests. Patrick, we will be talking with you, I'm sure, about this in the future. Patrick Christie, again, our guest from the Foreign Policy Initiative. Thank you for your work there, and keep it up. We'll look forward to a further chat in the near future. Next up, we'll talk with Jim Hansen about Chris Kyle, an American hero, and much more. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Do you see that doggy in the shelter?
Hi, I'm Buddy, the adorable puppy you adopted from the Humane Society.
Meow. I'm Whiskers, a fluffy kitty, just waiting for someone to love me.
When you adopt a pet, we hope your new furry friend will become a cherished member of your family. And as Buddy and Whiskers will tell you, the key to success is following the rules to love by.
Woof, that's right. Please give me food, water, and exercise every day. To stay healthy, I need the same kind of things you need.
Talk to me. I like hearing your voice.
You're my best friend. Please don't stay mad at me or lock me up as punishment. Remember, I'm probably going to live 10 to 15 years, so take care of me when I get old.
One day you'll need someone to take care of you, too.
A message from the Montgomery County Humane Society. Visit www.mchumane.org for the complete rules to love by.
Be your best friend for life.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, the Threat to America at amazon.com.
Hi, I'm Casey Kane. You would think that as NASCAR's 2004 Rookie of the Year, I get my biggest thrill driving fast. But it's off the racetrack that I get one of life's greatest rewards, helping others through volunteer service. Working with kids is one way that I try to make a difference. The first time I visited chronically ill children in the hospital, I found out just how rewarding volunteering could be. By giving a little of my time, it brightened their day. I was so inspired that I started my own foundation to help sick children and kids without an opportunity to have a better chance at life. Through volunteer service, you learn things about the people you're helping, and you find out a few things about yourself. Volunteering is a rush, just like taking the checkered flag. Go to volunteer.gov to find out what drives you.
This is President George W. Bush. USA Freedom Corps has a volunteer opportunity that's just right for you. Visit volunteer.gov. When you help your neighbor, you help your nation.
So what's the deal? You gonna get a job now or what?
Did you have to shoot anyone?
Why are you so distant? Are you not happy to see me?
No one knows what it's like to come back from Iraq or Afghanistan unless they were there. Join other veterans at communityofveterans.org, brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Jim Hansen, one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio. He brings the boots on the ground perspective, I like to think, to our topics and is the, among other things, the co-founder and senior director of communications for the Warrior Legacy Foundation. And this week, as you know, Jim, we memorialized and buried a remarkable man, an American sniper, I think he styled himself as. In fact, the best sniper in the history of the United States by Pentagon Records. His name was Chris Kyle. Tell us your thoughts on the loss of this this great warrior and the circumstances under which that loss took place.
You know, Frank, it's always stunning when you have someone who survived as many just hellaciously dangerous situations to come back and be doing something relatively benign. You know, the left may not consider a shooting range a safe place, but they are. You know, a shooting range in America is probably safer than the highway in a lot of instances. And Chris Kyle was just teaching shooting. And, you know, he was shot by somebody with some what looked like some fairly serious mental health issues. You know, the the particulars of what the problems this kid who shot him has are haven't really come to light yet, and I don't know that we'll ever, you know exactly why, but it's just ironic is too mild a word for someone who survives that much combat and then meets a violent death here in the United States. It's a tragedy, and I mourn for his family and hope you know something good can come of paying attention to the mental health issues that led to his death.
Yeah, Jim. Of course, you served in the Special Forces yourself with the United States Army. You've had close encounters with this phenomenon of what's known as post-traumatic stress disorder, and evidently that's what Chris was trying to help this young man cope with through this kind of mentoring and training. A tragedy, obviously, for the family, but as you say, a real insight for all the rest of us as to both his service, both in uniform and after he left the service, and these mental health problems that are afflicting a lot of those who have served. Jim, another warrior was recognized this week. Talk to us about Staff Sergeant Clinton Ramesha and his exploits and the recognition that he justly received.
Yeah, well, back in 2009, there was a fairly amazing battle that took place at an area called Combat Outpost Keating in Afghanistan. And most of the things that have been written or discussed about it have attempted to portray it as a failure of leadership, you know, another situation like the Battle of Lanat, where our troops were put in the situation of facing a superior enemy, a superior number, I won't say superior enemy, and, you know, tried to make it seem that somehow that should never have happened. And unfortunately, it does happen. You know, our enemies may not be decent human beings, and they may not be real military, but they can occasionally get more people in one place than we have, and that's what happened at Cop Keating. And as they were attempting to, you know, basically overrun this place with several times the number of men we had, Clinton Ramesha stopped them. You know, he and the rest of the guys there did. And he did some things that, you know, are in the best tradition of U.S. military service. And it does my heart good to see that those, you know, brilliant, heroic actions are recognized rather than simply looking at this and saying we should never have our troops in a situation where they're forced to do this. You can't guarantee that, Frank. And you cannot do that. When you put our troops in harm's way, you put them in harm's way. And the great thing about them is they will react like Staff Sergeant Ramesha did, and he was rightly recognized, and I think it is a wonderful moment, and I really greatly commend him and all the rest of his troops and those who fell that day.
Yeah, it is an extraordinary story, as are really all of these exploits. Is not doing justice to it. It is acts of immense courage in the face of often the most dangerous of conditions. And Jim, you've been there. You know this firsthand, and it's really great to get your insights into what a guy like Staff Sergeant Ramesha overcame to you know defend his position and those of his comrades. Speaking of defending our troops and, for that matter, our countrymen, you've mused at I think it was at Black5.net, where you blog frequently, Jim Henson, about the peculiar sort of disconnect between the policies of the Obama administration as they relate to the use of drones to kill people they believe are enemy terrorists, including Americans, and their unwillingness to use some other techniques, including waterboarding, to extract information from them. Talk a little bit about that disconnect, if you would.
Frank, it baffles me. You know, maybe I can't wrap my tiny mind around the serious, you know, strategery of the Obama administration, but it would seem to me that if you waterboard someone, ask them a few questions, and they live at the end of it, you've done less damage to them than if you blast them into their component molecules using a Hellfire missile. You know, I would think that, you know, maybe common sense wise that was the case.
Yeah.
Apparently not.
Certainly sounds like it.
Still, yeah, well, I would have thought so. You probably would have thought so. But apparently it is more just and a better idea to just simply kill someone without asking any questions rather than pour a little water on their face and make them uncomfortable. And they maintain that position to that this day. They're brand new, you know, bright and shiny, soon-to-be CIA director, the incompetent John Brennan, was an architect of the drone policy and has had to run away from the fact that he was also well aware that we were waterboarding people and gaining actionable intelligence from them. So somehow that, you know, that incoherence is official Obama team policy, and I can't grasp it.
Well, it does strike me as not only absurd, but really counterproductive, because as you know so well, Jim Hansen, the difference between the success in a war like this and our defeat may well turn on whether we have the best intelligence we can obtain. And if you are, as you say, putting these people into their component molecules rather than extracting that information from them, that may, again, make the outcome of this a lot less to our liking. Let me ask you this, Jim. You, of course, served in the United States Army, the Special Forces. You were, I assume, in the course of that, subjected to a bit of this waterboarding yourself, were you not? Did you get that SEER training? And if so, did you feel as though you were being tortured? And how could we do that to our own people if it is, in fact, torture?
Well, again, another piece of brilliant incoherence and cognitive dissonance from our moral superiors on the left. Yeah, I've been waterboarded. And guess what, Frank? I hated it. It was miserable. And I caved very, very quickly and went ahead and signed the paper because it is a Jedi mind screw. It convinces your brain that you're drowning, even though you're not. And so you immediately decide that it's not worth it. And I think if someone has information, you know, they always say you can't, you know, torture makes people lie to make it stop. Yeah, well, unless they have something they can tell you that'll make it stop, they will. So it's a useful tool that in extreme cases we should have in our arsenal. And the fact that we don't shows that we value posing more than we value actual security, and that's a disgrace.
It would be just a disgrace, Jim Hansen, I must say, if it didn't have such ominous implications that again, we've denied ourselves information that we might otherwise urgently require to try to deal with a threat that is, unfortunately, despite the president's characterization of it again last night in the State of the Union address, only metastasizing further. Jim Hansen, as always, we appreciate your insights, your candor, and your portrayal of these heroes, fallen and still with us, who served with such distinction alongside people like yourself. Thank you for your past service as well, Jim, and for helping us get that boots on the ground perspective. We'll look forward to talking with you about it further in the near future. We'll look forward to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.